Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the volatile standoff between Russia and Ukraine, made even more unsettling by Vladimir Putin's press conference, which was so full of contradictions and fabrications that many wonder what kind of advice and information the Russian president is getting. Catherine Stoner, the Deputy Director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University and author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, joins us to discuss the extent to which Putin is delusional or cynical or both. Then we look into the prospect of a new Cold War with Russia, in particular if the crisis in Ukraine goes from bad to worse, with Putin becoming more isolated and defiant. Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Johnson and Nixon, who is completing a book on a comparative history of the United States and Soviet Russia, joins us to discuss how much the unraveling events in Ukraine could turn back the clock. Then finally, following Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to the White House, we will examine the likely impact of worsening relations between the U.S. and Russia on the faltering efforts to end the murderous and destructive war in Syria. Aaron David Miller, who has been an advisor to six secretaries of state and has an article at CNN, Putin's move could be costly to U.S. and Middle East, joins us to discuss the consequences for the Middle East of both a Putin victory and a Putin defeat in Ukraine. And joining us now is Catherine Stoner, who is a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director at the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She is the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stoner.
Having me.
And I don't know whether you saw the press conference that Vladimir Putin held with the Kremlin press pool, but it was very strange that he would say, you know, that Yanukovych is still the acting president of Ukraine, but he can't talk to Ukraine because Ukraine has no president. Ukraine needs elections, but you can't have elections because there is already a president and no elections will be valid given that there's terrorism in the streets, etc. So what did you make of it?
It was a little confused and confusing, actually, which is unusual for Putin because he's usually very secure in you know, facts. And this did seem contradictory, as you noted, in a number of ways.
So is I've heard rumors, and I've spoken to people who've had meetings with Putin in the Kremlin, and they have suggested that he is in a bit of a bubble, that he's surrounded by yes men, and he doesn't necessarily get a full picture of what's happening in the outside world because of the sycophants around him.
Yeah, so it's not just sycophants. It's also, you know, one wonders what information he's getting exactly. I mean, he referred to having seen a swastika or on someone's black armband in Kiev. So, you know, how did he see that? And from that, he extrapolated that there were, you know, fascists. That's, you know, he's. I wouldn't say he's in such a bubble that he's easily manipulated. But you know, he's a victim, I guess, of those around him to some degree, at least.
Well, he did, you know, as he's done from the beginning, suggest that this is not about the Ukrainian people rejecting a kleptocratic regime and wanting good governance, but rather that they're being manipulated by the American CIA. Mm-hmm. He talked about the American political technologists did their work well, and it isn't the first time that they've done this in the Ukraine. I get the feeling that these people in America, they're sitting around in their laboratories and doing experiments like on rats. So, I mean, how delusional do you think he is? Is he as I mentioned in the opening, is he delusional? Is he cynical? Or is he both?
I would actually say cynical because he's not. Delusional. I actually was at a relatively small meeting with him at the end of September, and I've been in small groups with him before, and he is usually, you know, completely on top of his message. And so this is actually that part about the lab rats. That's actually not too far from his regular message. What he's suggesting there is that, you know, all of that the overthrow of Yanukovych was somehow orchestrated by the United States and you know, the National Democratic Institute USAID and all of the organizations, the International Republican Institute, that he has kicked out of Russia in the last year and a half. And, you know, he thought our former ambassador, who's my colleague here at Stanford, Michael McFaul, had initially come, you know, to foment revolution when he was appointed ambassador just over 2 years ago. So that's an older storyline and one that he's been on for a while. He sees deeper machinations in Ukraine and in particular with the United States and Europe coming right up to what he thinks of as Russia's natural historical sphere of influence. And he's trying to draw a line in the snow, if you will, in Ukraine. That is, as he also said in the news conference, a brother nation.
Again, I'm speaking with Catherine Stoner, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director of the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, The Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. So if he's cynical, then does he believe that there are Nazis running amok in Kiev with a swastika armband? I mean, a lot of people have been repeating that. I've been getting a lot of mail saying that this is all the Nazis and the anti-Semites are all behind that. I mean, there are a couple of right-wing parties, Right Sector and Svoboda, Freedom Party. I believe they have there are some nationalists, I think four posts in the government from Svoboda, even though its leader, who's been accused of anti-Semitism, is not in the government. And I believe somebody on the National Security Council has a deputy who, Dmytro Yarosh, who's the head of the far-right paramilitary group called Right Sector. So is there any substance to these claims?
You know, not really, despite what you just said. I think if you have demonstrations with hundreds of thousands of people in them, then you get all kinds of crazies who come to the party. And so that, you know, was there that dimension in a very, very small way on the streets of Kiev and Euromaidan? Yes, but that's not what the movement was about at all, and that was not the message at all. And, you know, I think Mr. Putin is partly selling that line for a domestic audience to revive in the memories of Russian citizens in Russia, you know, the threat of the Second World War and the memories of Russians with respect to the Second World War, very, very long. They obviously lost millions and millions of people. So that's one issue. The second is, you know, he's right, trying to create this sense of an external threat, and that you know, it is up to him and to Russia to save Ukraine from this external threat. So on the one hand, it's fascistic, but on the other hand, it's also the United States getting involved somehow. There's just simply no evidence of any of this. You know, just like, you know, he's trumping up the accusation that ethnic Russians were being threatened in Crimea. Well, there's no evidence of that. The only people who've died so far in the last week and a half, are ethnic Ukrainians. Viktor Yanukovych, his security agencies, shot 70 of them.
Right, but Putin said that they were shot by right-wing provocateurs.
Well, he said they were shot by snipers. Yes, we're not clear who hired the snipers, but he's suggesting that Yanukovych didn't. Right. But at the same time, here is another contradiction in the news conference. At the same time, he's saying that Yanukovych withdrew his security too quickly from the square and ran away. And he warned him not to do that, he said, in this press conference. And so as a result, Yanukovych has lost his country.
But he's also saying that those troops without insignia that have taken over Crimea are not Russian. I mean, there was a confrontation between the Ukrainian soldiers who were unarmed and marched up to the Russians, these people without insignias who fired over their heads. There have been efforts on the part of pro-Russian thugs to stop the press and the wives and mothers of some of the besieged Ukrainian soldiers from delivering food and parcels, etc. So that's, to me, that's where the volatility is, isn't it? I mean, what's your sense of whether or not this volatile situation could be sparked by some misunderstanding or bad move?
Sure. So that is a real danger. And I think there are different, you know, the fact is there are different groups. So on the one hand, we have some political tourists or demonstrator tourists. Who have either taken it upon themselves to go from Russia into Ukraine to participate in whatever happens. On the other hand, we have some who are definitely paid by Russia to go and stir things up. On the third hand, what Mr. Putin was suggesting, and this is just not credible, that the men in green, as they're called in Ukraine, these soldiers without insignia, are somehow local militias. The only way in which they could be local militias is that they've come from the Black Sea Fleet base that Russia has there. That's how they're local. There's no doubt that they're Russian. We've had different officials tell us they're Russian, and then they're also traveling in vehicles with the black license plate of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. No doubt there. Yes, I think there is a real danger, though, that some either Russian militia or regular army from the Navy, from the Black Sea Fleet, or a Ukrainian soldier fires accidentally or on purpose. In fact, we had some firing over the heads of Ukrainian soldiers today. That could actually spark a real conflict, and I think that's really the danger, and partly perhaps why he was reminding, you know, the audience that Ukrainians are our brothers in arms, and that these soldiers will be fighting on the same side of the barricades as the Ukrainian soldiers.
But that's my understanding, is that what polling we have from inside Russia is the Russian people are not behind the idea of a war with Ukraine. They do see these people as their brothers and sisters.
Yeah, so it's interesting. There's about a 60% approval of what he's doing, which is occupying Crimea. It's not being presented to them, though, as a war with Ukraine. It's this particular illegitimate government that has kicked out Yanukovych that is threatening ethnic Russians by passing a language law that downgraded the status of the Russian language as being equal to the Ukrainian language within Ukraine. That's, you know, more of an affront, I would say, to your average Russian. And also, we're coming off the Olympics. I think we've almost all forgotten about the Olympics having just happened. Mm-hmm. And there was a real swell of nationalism. Obviously, Russia did well and won the medal count in the Olympics. The Olympics were pulled off, thankfully, without any kind of terrorist attack. And so, I think nationalist pride was on the rise anyway. And so he's got to play to a domestic audience. So while there may not be a stomach for war with Ukraine, they're thinking of it more, and it's being presented more as a war against illegitimate leaders who may be threatening poor ethnic Russian brethren.
But along with the lie that's going around the world that the Ukrainian revolution is being propagated by the CIA and by fascists and anti-Semites, this whole language law, which was after all something that Yanukovych put in and that was repealed, and then it was repealed again. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a red herring, isn't it?
It's absolutely a red herring, of course. Again, the suggestion that Yanukovych has invited in the Russian army is also absurd, right? He on Friday in his own press conference had said, I don't I certainly hope the military doesn't get involved. And then Vitaly Churkin, the UN ambassador, Russia's UN ambassador, that is, waved around a letter saying, here, look, this is why we're in Crimea. Yanukovych just signed this yesterday, Monday. So, you know, I think there are a lot of contradictions. I think there's that's actually one of the, I think, most absurd things about all of this is the Russian perspective is just so wildly different from the Europeans and the Americans in particular.
So what is happening then diplomatically? I mean, it seems to me that John Kerry showing up in Kiev, it might have been more useful had he gone to Moscow. You know, there's no point in feeding Putin's paranoia. But what are they? Is anybody talking about the 1994 Budapest Memorandum, where the U.S., Russia, Ukraine, and the UK agreed not to threaten or use force against the territorial integrity or political independence of Ukraine, and Crimea is a part of Ukraine?
Yeah. So you know, it has been mentioned, and it's been waved at the Russians. But they're looking at this as, you know, I think the example that Putin used in his press conference was Serbia and Kosovo, and how the United States was supporting Kosovars for, you know, in their press for self-determination within Serbia. And so he's pointing to that and saying, look, you know, we have ethnic Russians within Crimea, and so, you know, they have the right to have themselves, you know, have self-determination and be protected, and so we won't push it, but we will, you know, we will protect them just as you did with the Kosovars. So he's saying this is an exception to 1994 for this reason.
Well, he also said in his press conference that the U.S. Invaded Iraq and Afghanistan and misinterpreted the U.N. mandate over Libya or used it towards their own ends. And frankly, he's got a point there. I mean, it almost feels as if the Bush-Cheney administration is the gift that keeps on giving to those around the world who want to point out American hypocrisy.
Sure, although Libya was under this administration, of course, the sure. Obama administration. But that's the line that you will hear, and I've had almost shouted at me in the last couple of years from representatives of the foreign ministry that, you know, the United States has been aggressive and has not, it's, you know, we view here in the United States our intentions as benign and helpful, but the Russians have interpreted, you know, first, there we are in Serbia, bombing them over Kosovo, and I happened to be in Russia when that was happening, and watching Russian television, you know, you can kind of understand Serbo-Croatian if you speak Russian, and even friends of mine who I would have thought of as liberal-minded and you know, speak English and were very affronted by that, that the U.S. is being far too aggressive. Then we are putting in anti-ballistic missile bases in Poland and the Czech Republic. And then there we are in Libya. There we are in Iraq before that. Libya, the Russians view us as exceeding the UN mandate, which they went along with. And, you know, former president, now Prime Minister Medvedev, has been sidelined largely because of that, because it looked weak. So, you know, their perspective is that the U.S., is dancing in the end zone, if you will, after the winning the Cold War, and Russia is pushing back in what it views as its natural sphere of influence.
Well, Catherine Stoner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stoner, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for International Studies, deputy director at the Center for Democratic Development and the Rule of Law, as well as faculty director of the Ford Dorsey Program in International Policy Studies at Stanford University. She's the author of Resisting the State, Reform and Retrenchment in Post-Soviet Russia, and Local Heroes, the Political Economy of Russian Regional Governance. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the prospects of a new Cold War with Russia.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our friend. prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he is also completing a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia, kindred rivals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And we were just speaking then about Putin's press conference, where he did appear to be somewhat contradictory and we use the word delusional, but our previous guest suggested it's more cynicism than delusion. But she also said, you know, that Russians generally feel that the U.S., as she put it, has been dancing in the end zone, having won the Cold War, and they've been pushing up against Russia's borders, inexorably moving east from Europe. And we don't see things the way they see things.
Well, that's absolutely right. If one looks at the map from a Russian point of view, that old Cold War boundary that, of course, was quite fortified with barbed wire and tank traps and all the rest has now moved almost 1,500 kilometers to the east. It for all intents and purposes, the warning time for any Russian regime for an attack from the West or any kind of an aggression, covert or overt, has been reduced now to only moments. This is the geostrategic nightmare, Ian, of every Russian regime. Really going back to Catherine the Great, which was why largely why they took the Ukraine and what was Belarusia then, and participated in the partition of Poland. This is a long time honored traditional interest in a buffer in Central and Eastern Europe, and the United States in, I think, one of the most thoughtless and destructive sequels in world politics. After the end of the Cold War, principally under Bill Clinton, not so much under George H.W. or under W., although certainly after Clinton, W. continued the trend, pushed that boundary of Western influence and power right up to the doorstep of the Russians. And that has had incalculable effect, both in geostrategic terms and in terms of the mentality of the politics in Moscow. We really don't have anything like the assumption of goodwill and of cooperation and of amity that was there, of course, in those first very heady, very hopeful days. You remember them well, after the end of the Cold War.
So, in terms of what's happening now, though, where you have in the press conference Putin talking about American political technologists experimenting as though they're experimenting in rats in a dark puddle in a laboratory, it does seem that, you know, as the previous guest suggests, he's not so much delusional, he's cynical. So perhaps he doesn't actually believe this stuff, but he's saying it. But it seems to me that the story here is that most of the people in Ukraine basically want better governance. They don't want to be ruled by a kleptocratic family that stole something like 6% of the GDP, and they're now $70 billion missing, for God's sake. You know, they're sick of paying bribes to everybody, and they'd like a better form of governance. And frankly, the governance that Putin's offering by returning this crook or demanding that this crook is still a legitimate leader. And if you look at what's the kind of governance in Russia, which is a sort of mob ruled kleptocracy regulated by Putin and his KGB cronies, little wonder people want to choose the more European model as opposed to the Russian model.
You know, I must say, in looking at this whole episode, at this so-called crisis, and I think it is a crisis in some respects, we are through the looking glass in so many ways. In fact, I was thinking today that there is a line. I'm not sure whether it's the White Queen or who it is who tells Alice at one point, this business of memory is no good if it only looks backward. And it's the backward memory here on all sides that's getting us in trouble. I find it amusing that Americans are speculating about the bubble that Putin is in. Most certainly he is in a bubble. He is getting what his intelligence services tell him, but he's also, as I said earlier, getting a very long and venerated tradition of the way Russia looks at these problems in terms of his own sense of security and the greatness of the country that he hopes to leave behind. It obviously is a dictatorship. It's an oligarchy. It's more layered than Americans tend to think. I think his power is much more diffuse. He does have factions that contend and constituencies that he must satisfy. There's no question about that. But he is getting a distorted and a particular slant on all of this. But then so, of course, is Washington. I must say, Ian, in my own research, I've been through literally hundreds of KGB documents from the 1970s and 80s and on. They resemble nothing so much as their counterparts in the CIA. Intelligence services and governments tend to see what they want to see, believe what they want to believe. They obviously act often on miscalculations, and Putin is no exception in that respect. You're absolutely right about the diversity of the Ukrainian revolution. I think that this may go down well as one of the more truly democratic expressions that we've seen in a very long time. Yes, there were right-wing elements. Yes, in the initial stages, there were anti-Semitic and old neo-Nazi groups that were involved. But for the most part, this was a very spontaneous, very popular, very modern, often with a very secular left wing orientation. The young people, especially, who, as you say, are very European oriented, but they're mostly anti-corruption, as indeed the protesters in Tahrir Square were in Cairo, as they have been through the Arab Spring in the Middle East. The corruption of that regime in Kiev was so far over the top, beyond even the example set by the oligarchy in St. Petersburg or Moscow, beyond anything else that we've seen in Eastern Europe. It was so egregious that it really drove the country into the kind of despair economically that resulted in these competing offers, as it were, from the EU on one side, the $160 million a year bailout that they were going to pose, and the $15 billion cash on the barrelhead that Putin offered, which, of course, the Kiev regime ended up taking and which triggered this whole crisis. But they were certainly in a class by themselves. It was, if there was ever a legitimate revolution in the streets, a democratic uprising against an elected government that was justified, it was this one. And I do think that the United States has been playing games in Eastern Europe for a very long time. So has the EU. American intelligence was certainly on the ground. There were NGOs that were performing their usual duty for Washington and for the national security state. But this was, to a very large extent, a truly popular and spontaneous revolution.
Well, you know, Putin actually mentioned in this strange press conference that that Yanukovych was a cheat, but he also said that some of the people replacing him were cheats, which I'm sure is Yulia Yamashenko, who is the woman that was in jail, who was worth hundreds of millions of dollars from some crooked gas deal. So there's no shortage of cheats, as Putin has said. But
and many of those crooks and cheats, of course, were our crooks and cheats, our villains, as it were. America did not find a reason to be upset about corruption in the Ukraine until there was this rather more blatant resort to Russia and the turn eastward. Although even then, you know, the regime resisted the worst part of the Eurasian Initiative, resisted really tying its hands completely, because the Ukraine, I think, ideally, whether it's run by crooks or by reasonably responsible statesmen, has to do a balancing act between East and West. Wants the best, if it possibly can manage it, the best of both worlds, and certainly ought to have that. The failure of the West to see that, the attempt of the West to seduce and to co-opt and to manage, which was so vivid, of course, in the eavesdropped telephone conversation that we heard from Victoria Nuland and her ambassador, that's the kind of manipulation that Washington has been practicing for years. And to that extent, Putin is by no means delusional. He and his intelligence services know about that, and the United States here has been, I think, for the most part, guilty of some of what of Putin is accusing us of.
So, given that I was mentioning earlier that I think that Kerry's made a mistake by not going to Moscow instead going to Kiev, I don't think there's any sense in feeding Putin's paranoia. What is your sense that going forward? You know, it just seems like that the Russians and the Americans are talking past each other, which is exactly what they were doing during the Cold War.
Well, absolutely, and the famed or the notorious reset of the Obama administration never really took place. I think there needs to be nothing less here, Ian, than a rather major transformation of American policy toward Russia and toward that part of the world in general. We're talking a lot now about being able to punish and hurt the Russians because they are, unlike their Soviet predecessors, they are so integrated into the global economy. So many billions invested in Europe. Such a stake in its European markets, which are beginning to dwindle. The Russian economy is in deep trouble, due to grow at 1%. This is going to be a very difficult time for them. This is exactly the moment when the United States ought to do what it should have done 20 some years ago, in the wake of the Cold War, and try to bring this country in a more integrated and sensible and fair and balanced way into the community of nations. Vladimir Putin is not going to live forever. He is a thug, as you put it, as a KGB thug. He's surrounded by thugs and oligarchs. But this is, in its deepest manifestation, an inherently democratic country, and in any case, an extremely powerful one, and one that needs to be integrated in a sensible, long-term way into the international economy and into the political framework of whatever world America wants to live in the 21st century. We haven't even begun to do that. Veritable encirclement of the old Soviet Union, of the new Russia, and the maintenance basically of a military strategy as well as a political isolation was lethal. And that doesn't work. It's not going to work. Putin's attempt here in the Ukraine, of course, is not going to work for long, although these things are always dangerous. A bunch of people running around with guns and armies facing each other, and populations that are politically rot are this is a dangerous moment, and it needs to be managed with more wisdom than Washington has shown thus far.
Well, but in contrast to what you said, we should be doing, we're doing what we used to do in the Cold War, which is punish the Russians by isolating them further. In effect, we shoot ourselves in the foot. The punishment for Putin now is that we're not going to go to the G8.
We're confirming all of their expectations of our behavior, of our attitude, their expectations of what our purposes and goals are. I think it's the creation. We talk a lot about trust. And about cooperation and collaboration, and we're doing nothing here but fostering mistrust and unilateral action. I think they see each other. You know, it reminds me of the old expression by Alexander III, who said Russia in the 19th century. Russia only has two friends: its army and its navy. That almost is the way Putin sees it today. This was a reckless act, a desperate act. By the way, I think it has much more to do with Putin's own domestic political prospects, his own strength, his own worries and anxiety about his political base in Russia than it does really even with the politics of relationship with the Ukraine. But this was a line that I think he felt he had to draw. And it's been created by past American actions, as your earlier guest talked about. This has been a quarter century of blundering and of belligerence and of lack of imagination and lack of vision on the part of Washington. This is still, with all due respect to the Chinese and to the new Europe and all of that, this is still the single most important and powerful nation on the planet, in addition to the United States. I need not remind you of its nuclear arsenal and of its potential. And whatever its periodic weakness is these days, it won't last. They are going to be one of the truly great powers of the 21st century, and we had best have them as friends and even allies rather than adversaries.
Well, what bothers me, Roger Morrison, I spoke with an independent defense analyst on Sunday, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is the only newspaper left that Putin doesn't control. He was actually quite alarmed by what had happened and thought things could really go out of hand and that Russia could get bogged down and you could end up with a really long war, and that the Ukrainians, even though they've got a weak military, have the tremendous potential to fight a long guerrilla war. The Tatar minority in Crimea could rise up and join in the jihadi movement, etc. There's a lot of downside to what Putin is doing, and when
absolutely, and I think we always need to remember in the case of Russia or other powers like this, you can always get something worse than the devil you're facing, the devil you know.
Right.
Putin could fall, his regime could fall after a very costly and savage war in the Ukraine. I don't think they can sustain that for very long, whatever the outcome would be. The politics in the Ukraine, again, and this is part of being through the looking glass with the American media, not all the Russian-speaking Ukrainians are necessarily in favor of this intervention, this incursion.
Well, they're not. It's pretty clear that there are actually large demonstrations in Donetsk today against the Russian incursion.
Russians, and in Odessa, you've got these large cities. This is the Rust Belt of the Ukraine, the old industrial East. This is a complicated and layered political picture that Washington needs to be much more alert to. I saw and heard nothing in that telephone conversation with Nuland, the neoconservative to whom Obama entrusted his European policy. I saw nothing in that conversation to suggest that we had anything like a sophisticated view.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. His new book, Between the Graves, is about the U.S. history of U.S.-Afghan relations and American policy in South Asia based on thousands of previously secret documents. And he's also completing a book on a comparative history of the inner politics of the United States and Soviet Russia, kindred rivals. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the impact of the war, of a possible war in Ukraine on the Middle East.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Hey, rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation. What is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aaron David Miller, the Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who has been an advisor to six Secretaries of State. Under President Clinton, he served as a Deputy Special Middle East Coordinator for Arab-Israeli Negotiations. And his books include The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and his latest, Can America Have Another Great President? He has an article at CNN, Putin's Move Could Be Costly to U.S. Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron David Miller.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, the president met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Monday in the White House, and he's made a statement saying over time, talking about Ukraine, this will be a costly proposition to Russia, and now is the time for them to consider whether they can serve their interests in a way that resorts to diplomacy as opposed to force. What do you think was Netanyahu's advice to him, given that he's right next door to Syria, which is obviously a very contentious situation?
Well, I'm not sure the president solicited his advice on American policy toward Ukraine. I mean, I think the prime minister's view is clear, and small powers look at the behavior of great ones; they follow it with great curiosity and with great interest. And you know that the North Koreans, the Syrians, the Iranians, and the Israelis and others are following this particular crisis, looking for an assertive, even muscular response from the United States. And I suspect they're going to be disappointed. Geography, history, proximity, Putin's own national interests basically puts the president in a very disadvantaged position. The Russians have already acted, and operationally they're in control of Crimea, and I think their objective is fundamentally not to let Crimea drift west. And I think it's going to be extremely difficult to stop them. They may well end up being part of the problem and part of the solution whenever this crisis abates, ends up having to negotiate a way out. So no good options for Obama. And it's going to make an already difficult Middle East set of issues and a Middle East agenda even that much more difficult.
But it sounds like things could get hotter in Ukraine with Russia's UN envoy Vitaly Cherkin in a speech at the UN saying that Mr. Yanukovych, the deposed leader of Ukraine, had made a request in writing to Russian President Vladimir Putin to use military force in Ukraine. So is your sense that things could get worse?
Well, the question is, what does Putin want? And how much leverage does he need? And to what degree and where does he have to project Russian military power in order to achieve that objective? I mean, in classic Putin style, he acted and he essentially is waiting to see what the response is. And I don't know if the Allies, the Germans now, are posing all kinds of difficulties in terms of what kinds of sanctions can be applied. The Brits aren't sure what exactly we're going to be able to do to stop them. I mean, this is a very tricky issue. I'm not an expert in Eastern Europe, in former Soviet Union, or Ukraine. But I know this, that we have now gotten ourselves into a situation where everyone says no to the United States without cost or consequence. Karzai of Afghanistan says no. Maliki of Iraq says no. Khamenei of Iran says no. Even our friends, the Egyptians, Israelis, Palestinians, usually say yes, but. So I think we really do have a problem. And I think the president has got to figure out a way to be as credible and as competent as possible, because this really is probably the most important crisis to date for his administration and for the legacy of his presidency, while he cares more about the middle class than he does about foreign policy. He's got 3 years left on the clock, and you put all these things together, Syria, how he deals with Iran, which at the moment seems to be positive rather than negative, and Ukraine, and you, even if you concede that most Americans really do want a much lower profile foreign policy, they don't want to see their country humiliated and disrespected. And that's the balance that the president has to find. I don't envy him, because I'm not sure there's a credible set of responses that could reverse these gains and constitute a win.
But Aaron David Miller, do you think that we have been humiliated by the deal that with Syria, which there are reports that Putin has contempt for Obama, it may even be tinged with a certain racism, but it looks as if Putin took Obama to the cleaners over Syria. He made the deal, and only 4% of these chemical weapons have apparently been corralled. The deal essentially puts Assad in control of the deal.
The reality is, unless the United States was prepared to apply direct military pressure and intercede in what is clearly a civil war that is likely to endure well beyond the Obama administration in some form or another, then we're going to be affecting the situation from the sidelines. And I think there's a great reluctance to use force in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan that isn't carefully calibrated to achieving a clear set of objectives. I mean, after all, military power, and I've supported the president in terms of his risk aversion when it comes to Syria, military power is an instrument. That's all it is. It's an instrument to achieve a set of objectives. And if they're not thought through carefully and clearly, then you end up with Iraq and Afghanistan, where the costs, given what we have gotten in return, are just so skewed on the downside. And I think the president, you know, is constantly wrestling with this notion. After all, his mandate was to extricate America from the two longest and among the least profitable wars in its history, and not to get the United States into new foreign military adventures. And the pendulum may have swung too much to the risk aversion side. That's what his critics claim, and then some. But by and large, he's created a policy that reflects the temper of his times. You take a look at the Pew poll. In 50 years, numbers on Americans reluctant or convinced that we're too ambitious in our foreign policy have never been higher. And that reflects the policies of Iraq and Afghanistan. It reflects the focus on our own broken house, debt, dysfunctional politics, deficit, dependence on hydrocarbons. I call them the six deadly D's. These represent slow bleeds which are sucking our national power, extracting it. And it's no wonder Americans aren't interested in foreign policy and don't see the point or purpose, unless our vital interests are at stake, and unless we can somehow at least create a risk calculation that offers the prospects of winning. That's the real problem.
Well, of course, the president didn't use force in Syria, and the American people were, I think, signaling pretty clearly that they didn't want him to do that.
But exactly.
I'm wondering whether Putin has misread that, and maybe the shoe is on the other foot now with Putin, where he's got himself embroiled in a reckless misadventure like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, you know, he shares a common... I mean, no, this is Russia's zone. The analogy here would be Cuba, or some variation of the Monroe Doctrine. No, I don't. The Russians may still stumble through overreach or through some unpredictable event in Ukraine itself. Who knows? But this is classic Russian nationalism, seeking to preserve what they consider to be their interests in their sphere and in their zone. We invaded Iraq, a country roughly the size population-wise of the state of California, with insufficient forces and a woeful misunderstanding of the politics there, with goals and objectives that were hardly realizable. It's no wonder we failed. And Putin's calculations, I think, are much different, and he feels a much higher confidence level. And the factors that might contribute to a win for Putin are much, much less complex than our enterprise in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But is there a possibility that Obama will revisit the Syrian policy, in as much as I mentioned earlier, it does look as if he made that deal, made Assad indispensable to the deal, and apparently the Russians are not being particularly helpful at Geneva. Do you think?
Syria's a lost cause. I mean, the only way Obama would revisit that policy is if somehow you could literally trace a terrorist attack against American interests or on American soil to Al Qaeda spinoffs, Jabhat al-Nusra, or some of the other groups to Syria proper. I find it almost unimaginable unless Assad completely abandons the Russian U.S. chemical framework, what is now a UN framework. Dismantle and destroy chemical weapons. I mean, there is not only is there no support in this country for unilateral military action. The question is, what is it designed to achieve? If the president tomorrow wanted to overthrow Bashar Assad, he could commit himself to an integrated, muscular policy that could do so. But then the question you have to ask yourself, what is the next step? You know, You take military action, you assume responsibility. Who's going to pay for Syria? Who's going to put in the billions required to unite the country? Who's going to produce the thousands of peacekeepers necessary to stop the vendettas and the bloodletting? Who's going to put Humpty Dumpty back together? I don't want America getting stuck with the check for Syria, and neither does the vast majority of the American public.
Well, we might get stuck with a check for Ukraine, which would be enormous.
No, we're not going to get stuck with a check. Uh-huh. Ukraine is in Europe.
But then
we're not going to confront the Russians militarily. We may be able to cobble together some sanctions. Maybe they're effective. Now, Ukraine is a Russian European problem, and it will remain primarily that. No matter how we try to own it.
Right, but it's an economic basket case that's been looted by the previous regime. That apparently there's nothing left in the treasuries.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
And you're not dealing with a bunch of Democrats either in terms of some of these opposition groups.
Exactly.
Who are extremist and anti-Semitic to boot.
Right.
So, you know, it's like, you know, again, we want Hollywood endings for all these things, and we're not going to have.
Right. Well, just in closing then, in terms of your point, though, about people around the world like the North Koreans and the Syrians and others not taking America seriously anymore, and even our allies saying yes, but, and they're not taking us seriously in the way that they've been used to. You know, if the president is behaving in a rational and reasonable way and doing exactly what you said, which is thinking about the consequences and being very judicious about using military force, what are we supposed to do to let the rest of the world know that we're not Uncle Sucker?
Well, you protect your vital interests. You project power when, in fact, you have a chance of succeeding. Our vital interests in the Middle East are four: preventing another attack against the continental United States, reducing our dependence on Arab hydrocarbons, extricating ourselves from Iraq and Afghanistan, and stopping Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Those are the four, and I didn't even put it on the list because it's so taken for granted, and that is maintaining a special relationship with the State of Israel, guaranteeing at least Israel's qualitative edge when it comes to its capacity to defend itself. The other two interests, what we do about the Arab Spring, intercession in the internal affairs of other countries, and the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace are discretionary. It's not that they're not important, it's just our capacity to fix these things is highly limited. So, well, I'm not calling for American isolation. I mean, I am calling, however, for a unforgiving assessment of what constitutes American interests and how best to achieve them. We don't have an interest. It may be construed as a vital interest of the United States to stop the Russian aggression in Crimea. The question is, how do you do it? And this notion of American credibility, which we tout, is fine. We need to be credible. Being credible means being believable. But you can pursue policies in defense and in the name of credibility that are stupid and lead to unbelievably negative consequences. Vietnam is a classic example. I mean, Iraq didn't start that way, but the investment, it became an investment trap. And it was a trap that we finally extricated ourselves from. But look at the results of a 9 or 10 year war. 6,000 plus Americans dead, trillions expended, a lot of American credibility, and for what? What is it that we actually achieved there that was worth the cost? And the same fate is in store for Afghanistan as well. So what are our vital interests in the world? Yes, it is not in our interest to see Putin gobble up Crimea. The question is, what can we do about it? And how to be smart about a response? And I think the president has no choice. I think Putin would have moved into Syria whether the Obama had launched a few cruise missiles back in September. It wouldn't have mattered. Crimea and Ukraine are vital Russian national interests. Full stop.
Well, Aaron David Miller, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Aaron David Miller, a vice president and distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who has been an advisor to 6 secretaries of state under President Clinton. He served as a deputy special Middle East coordinator for Arab-Israeli negotiations, and his books include The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace, and his latest, Can America Have Another Great President? He has an article at CNN, Putin's Move Could Be Costly to U.S. Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I am Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.